To the Crimea War 2014 edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, a harangue about how anti-vaxxers should be criminalized, a look at the Crimea conflict and what it means for a resurgent czarist Russia, and some gems from the web about how our electoral system is just plain buggered. Let's begin episode 247.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of spark stuff. We are aware of the cosmos and know it all.
Across the sea of space, the stars are other suns. We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. Tis I, Don, your political scientist and skeptical philosopher. Before I start into this week's harangue, I just wanted to put it out there. Everyone knows about the Malaysian airliner that has disappeared off the face of the earth. I'm surprised I haven't yet heard of too many people claiming that aliens are responsible for it, but we've pretty much ruled out that it's probably not a natural disaster or a technical foul-up, because we would have found debris by now. It doesn't seem to have been hijacking, because the whole point of hijacking is to let everyone know that, hey everyone, I did this and this is why you should pay attention to me. But one of the things that I think hasn't been explored that much is the idea of theft. I know it seems a little, I don't know, small-minded, but if you factor in that a Boeing 777 of its particular make is worth about, well, a little over $300 million, that's a pretty good heist by any standards. And of course, who knows what they might have done with the people. I don't think you would have killed them, but you might have left them on some small island. And I really don't know where you'd actually fence a stolen plane. But honestly, it seems to be the most likely explanation for what's been going on. So, I'm just putting it out there. I think when all comes to all, this may be seen as one of the greatest heists of all time. Could be curious. I'm sure there's a movie in the works. But let's get back to this week's harangue, and it's yet again about the anti-vax movement. Recently, there have been a number of outbreaks of measles in the Chilliwack area, and it has actually spread now to BCIT and the Vancouver proper. A new outbreak occurred in New York City as well as many other metropolitan centers around the continent. What makes this tragic is that in 1994, World Health Assembly pledged to eradicate measles and rubella in North America by the turn of the millennium. And guess what? They did it. Well, almost. It was eradicated by roughly 2002. The only place where you could find these measles on this continent were imported by new immigrants, who were also the only ones to really suffer from it. That was until about 2008, when measles reappeared on our shores. And to a point, you could blame newcomers for bringing disease to our shore, but the main reason that it managed to regain a foothold in this nation, as well as our southern neighbors, is because of the anti-science, anti-vax movement. In fact, the World Health Assembly of North America was forced to reset their date for regional eradication of measles to 2015 due to this new anti-vax resurgence. In fact, the number of cases have been increasing over the last couple of years. It is very insidious, these vectors of disease, these unvaccinated. You see, some misguided people believe they have a right to refuse vaccination against a well-known deadly preventable disease. It seems they are willing to put their supposed rights ahead of other people's lives, that they devalue others for their own sake. So I'm going to take a page out of their playbook. First, not that it need be said, but I'm going to advocate for very strong medicine, so it is incumbent upon me to state a very strong case. And I mean radical action, as in these people should be forced vaccination, and the anti-vax perpetrators of lies should be arrested. There are three things to know about this issue. What are the issues anti-vaxxers have with vaccination? What was it like before vaccination? And why it is not just a personal choice? Okay, to be generous to the anti-vax side, vaccinations have some risk. About 4 in 1,000 will have an adverse reaction requiring medical attention. It is usually a temporary swelling of the brain, but other issues may arise. Most of these issues have nothing to do with the vaccine per se, but an allergy to eggs. No, it's not a chicken cross the road joke, but vaccines are created largely from eggs. Weird, I know, but I will not bore you with the details. But a significant number of vaccines out there are incubated in chicken eggs. So if you're allergic to eggs, you will have a negative reaction to something like the measles vaccine. There are a few rare events where people may die from a vaccine, but that must be weighed against those who will die from the disease. More on that later. So are vaccines 100% benign? No. In fact, a lot of people will feel like shite after a vaccination because their body is mounting an attack on the disease. Of course, in this case, the attacker, i.e. the vaccine, has been hobbled, i.e. it looks like a big bad killer disease, but it's really kind of a faker. This is done by either sterilizing the virus or doing something else to prevent it propagating like it normally would. But that said, because the body thinks it's under attack, it mounts a complete defensive response. You see, vaccines work by tricking, important word there, tricking, the body into thinking that it is being invaded by a hostile pathogen. So after the sort of the fake fever, you have antibodies to kill the disease. In this case, measles. That is why a lot of people feel bad after getting a vaccination. The whole point of the shot is to trick your immune system into creating antibodies against a real attack. You may feel icky for a day or two, but that is way better than getting the actual disease. So your anti-vaxxer points out, obviously, that, quote, if vaccines are so good, why do vaccinations make you feel sick? It's a weak argument at best. They make you feel ill because that's how the immune system works. You feel sick without actually being sick. And no, it's not like some bullshit you hear about, quote, whole foods, where this miracle berry not only tastes good, but somehow magically boosts your immune system. The only way your immune system can fight a disease is to encounter it. Vaccine provides a baby's playpen environment for it to learn that this disease is bad, so that when your body faces the real big bad wolf of an infection, it knows how to kill it. Of course, the anti-vaxxers have other arguments that are based upon two premises. One, there are toxins in the vaccine, and the other, that the current regime of vaccines overwhelms the body with too many vectors. The first one, about toxins, well, vaccines at one time contained a preservative called thimerosal, which has as one of its components ethyl mercury. At first glance, one might say, oh no, doesn't mercury cause retardation of the brain? And yes, methyl mercury does do that. But in the same way that chlorine is in one instance a poison gas, it also makes up 50% of table salts. Or another more salient example, ethyl alcohol makes a good drink, while methyl alcohol will kill you. It is important to know what form a compound or chemical is to know its risk. The ethyl mercury is a safe for human use form of mercury. But even if it were the terrible toxin the anti-vaxxers make it out to be, it has not been used in general vaccines for children for over a decade. Of course, not to be outwooed, the anti-vaxxers then move the goalpost by pointing to aluminum salts, which they say cause an allergic reaction. And again, at first glance, one could say yes, but aluminum salts are actually an important part of the vaccination process. They are called adjuvants. The intent is to make the weak attack caused by our hobbled virus seem bigger than it really is. We do this to elicit as strong of an immune response as we can to ensure the antibodies are created early, are more potent, and the immunity lasts longer. So needless to say that at a certain dose, these salts can become toxic. However, that dose is in the grams per person, even an infant. And the amount used in a vaccination is micrograms. Also, the actual aluminum salt in question is aluminum acetate. This, according to the MSDS sheets, the Material Safety Data Sheets, the all-knowing database of every chemical ever used, and what risks are involved in using them, as well as what should we do if something happens with them. Anyway, the MSDS sheets for aluminum acetate states there may be slight irritation from this compound, but no other known effects. In labs, some of these effects have been shown on brain tissue, but these are labs with an active anti-vaccine agenda, who use doses far in excess of what we found in vaccines, as well as unrealistic methodology. Yes, I'm talking to you, Dr. Shaw. So what about the other angle? The vaccines in themselves may be okay, but the number and speed of vaccinations are harmful. This argument goes along the line that we are overwhelming the body's defenses by vaccinating against too many pathogens at too early of an age. This causes vaccinosis or something. Yes, the anti-vaxxers created a new illness called vaccinosis or chronic vaccine disease, which the people of the WHO say are a collection of real side effects already mentioned, but claim these effects are several order of magnitudes greater than they actually are. They also include a plethora of equally unsupported claims that vaccines cause MS or autism or SIDS. The WHO defines vaccinosis thusly: your search did not match any documents. And the CDC, on the other hand, defined it as no pages or documents found containing vaccinosis. So it's just pulled out of their ass. Now, it is true that kids are vaccinated against about 15 or so different diseases, and most of these shots occur before their first birthday. By age 5, they will be exposed to 5 attenuated organisms and about 15 antigens. Okay, attenuated organisms is fancy speak for the hobbled virus I already mentioned. So these are live viruses, but they are either specially bred infertile viruses that they live but they can't really reproduce, or they are close but less harmful relatives of the target vector. For example, cowpox, something as dangerous as a cold, was given to give immunity to smallpox, which wiped out millions of First Nation peoples. Antigens are part of the DNA that the virus has that sort of uniquely identify. By introducing the antigen, which cannot reproduce or even really do anything but just sort of be there, well, the body thinks anything that is not you or your friendly biome, well, it must be bad. So it launches an immune response to this DNA sort of photo. An analogy for those who still don't quite get it: think of a wanted poster. You display it at the post office. The picture itself is harmless, but it lets people know if you see the suspect, contact the police immediately. So if a real virus or bacteria shows up, the body immune system is alerted and an infection is aborted. Oh yes, and the term vector in this context is anything that can cause us harm. So virus, bacteria, even toxin. So where were we? Oh yes, that's a lot of stuff to be given a kid, no? The anti-vaxxers say, too much, too soon. Well, that depends. We produce antibodies every day. We live in a soup of viruses and bacteria. It is estimated by age 18, we will have been exposed and developed antibodies for anywhere between 1 and 100 million vectors. Remember, most of the viruses and bacteria are relatively harmless to us, but our body creates antibodies just in case. If we assume we are exposed on a proper sort of schedule, well, every day we are developing antibodies, or are exposed to antigens, depending on which way you look at it, from anywhere from 152 to 15,000 or so. So in the first year of our life, we are exposed to and create antibodies for 55,000 antigens. Suddenly 15 or 20 or even 200 vectors in a vaccine does not seem to be much of an overload for our immune system. Okay, so let's round out this segment. Are there any other arguments the anti-vaxxers might use? I'm going to kind of use this as sort of a shotgun round sort of quiz. So they might say, vaccines cause as many incidences of the disease as they cure. No. In the past, when live viruses were predominantly used, in rare circumstances, a vaccine could cause the infection. However, the current round of vaccines are almost completely free of live viruses. And irrespective of that, the possibility of infection from a vaccine, even back then, was a lot less than not being vaccinated at all. Another claim: it's my kid, and delaying vaccines will cause no harm. No, the longer you delay vaccinations, the longer the window you have created for your child to get infected. Which leads nicely into the next objection. If I choose not to vaccinate my kid, what concern of it is it of yours? Well, you don't live in a bubble. As has been made very clear with the reemergence of measles, the fact that you did not get your child vaccinated has put everyone in the community at risk. First, those people who are sort of immune to vaccines. That is, about 10% of the people vaccinated do not actually become immune for a variety of reasons. There are those people with weakened immune systems, the elderly, the sick, and kids who have not yet been vaccinated. There are immigrants who have never been immunized. If you or your kid gets sick, and even if you do not suffer greatly, everything you touch, think about when you go to the market, and about the number of people who touch that tomato before you, everyone you contact, every surface you touch, you are spreading the potential for disaster. By not being vaccinated, you have not only risked your own life or your child's life, but you have become a ticking time bomb for your community. And lastly, the anti-vaxxer might say, well, you said vaccines can cause side effects, and I just want to protect my child. Bullshit. There is a thing, no really, it's a thing, called relative risk. Everything we do has some risk. What a rational person does is to limit risk versus outcome. So if the risk of your child is 1 in a million, they may suffer a major side effect. Compared to 1 in 1,000, they will die from measles. 50 in 100 will become infertile from the mumps. And 85% of mothers will give birth to children with birth defects thanks to rubella. Well, it seems the obvious thing is to get the vaccination, that the countervailing risks are minor. That is one of the things that we suffer greatly from in this society, is that vaccines have been so successful, we no longer remember a time when these diseases were killers, where they infected lots and lots and lots of people and were a major problem to society. One of the greatest problems with vaccines is their success, that people no longer think we need them. Okay, so I think I have fully debunked the anti-vaxxer argument. I did not do this to refresh the memories of our loyal listeners, but because of this. There is yet another aspect I will leave you with. Some people will excuse others for being contrarians, but the reality is society can only allow a limited number of contrarians when it comes to infectious diseases. It is the standard number that if we can maintain a vaccination rate of about 95%, well, the rest of the population, for whatever reason, will remain immune due to isolation from the pathogen. It is referred to as herd immunity. Now, I bring this up because of Reverend Adrian Gaz of Chilliwack. Beyond my known disdain for this theist type, what this pastor is saying is dangerous. It could lead to the death of dozens of people, maybe millions. Let's go out there. He has advocated or religiously threatened that if a parent vaccinates their child, they will be condemned to hell. As he puts it, we leave it in God's hands. If it is his will that someone will get a contagious disease, like in the case of measles, there are other ways, of course, to avoid this. If I get sick, he can be called upon to heal us. The vaccination rate for East Fraser has dropped to about 65%. Remember that number I mentioned about herd immunity? Way below it. It is because of this that this region has seen several outbreaks of preventable diseases like measles. The disease is currently running amok in the Lower Mainland. How many have been harmed? Hundreds. How many may die? We hope none. But this is now up to chance. Now, I'm not going to make my usual atheist rant against an ignorant pastor. No, I'm going to make an argument that such talk should be made illegal. Now, the first reaction will be, Don, how dare you limit their right to free speech? No, any appeal to the right of freedom of religion would fall on deaf ears, but appeal to free speech, that's something I must address. It is true that a society, a free democratic society, can only exist if the greatest possible leniency to free speech is given. And I agree on this, but, you may say, what about your but? Insert cheap joke here. My exception is the classic. Your freedom of speech does not include yelling fire in a crowded theater. I can see no logical difference here. The diseases are real and take the lives of millions globally every year. Many of these ailments were eradicated from this country, eradicated until the anti-vax movement. It has been because of their lies and misconceptions that these diseases have once again plagued our nation. We cannot sit by and simply apply logical arguments against them. The stakes are too great. There is no gray area where their criticism may be valid. It is a black and white case where their propagation of ignorance is killing people. These people should not, must not, cannot be allowed to spew their bile into the public arena. I am attempting to relay the gravity of the situation. It should be a crime to propagate information that is deadly. Well, you might think that this is a little strong. Let us know your opinion by emailing us at info@radiofreethinker.com or commenting on the show notes at the blog. We will return after this break.
Today in the news.
And today in the news.
Today in the news.
Tired of the same few voices giving you the same point of view on the news? You're not alone. The Campaign for Democratic Media is a nonpartisan, nonprofit group fighting to ensure that our public airwaves represent more than just one voice. Canadians deserve diverse, accountable, and quality Canadian media. Visit democraticmedia.ca to learn how you can stand up for media issues.
And we're back. Forgive me by starting this segment out, but pointing out there are parallels between the Crimea crisis and the Sudetenland crisis that are amazing, in a very not nice and scary way. But more on that in the end. So I'm going to rehash a little bit of what we did during the Fun Drive show about sort of the history and the context of the whole Ukraine-Crimea crisis, but with a bit more add at the end of the recent changing events. So the road to revolution in the Ukraine started in Kiev in November, when President Yanukovych pulled up a free trade deal with the European Union, opting instead for a $15 billion aid package from Russia in cheap gas. This, along with Yanukovych pulling closer to Putin's custom union with Kazakhstan and Belarus, and the fact that much corruption has been reported about Yanukovych's government. This led to massive protests in the street that culminated in the apparent murdering of protesters by government forces. This led to Yanukovych fleeing the country, where he actually disappeared for a couple of weeks and then miraculously turned up in Russia. He's actually one of the reasons why Putin says that he didn't invade the Crimea, but actually Yanukovych had actually asked for the Russian intervention. Now it's important to note that this is not a from out of nowhere event. Although we see the collapse of the Soviet Union as a win, the Russians wonder why NATO didn't disband when the Warsaw Pact, its sister organization, disbanded. The ostensive purpose of NATO was to defend against the Soviet-led communist attack on Western Europe. After the Soviet Union broke apart, the reaction of the West was to increase NATO membership by including the Baltic states and overtures to Poland, Ukraine, and even Georgia, which is like on the eastern side of the Black Sea. From a Russian perspective, these moves are seen as a continuation of the Cold War, that the West did not just want the collapse of the Soviet Union, but the disintegration of Russia itself. Putin had been warning the US and other NATO states for at least 6 years not to impede on Russian interests in Ukraine, particularly in the Crimea, where the Black Fleet has been based since its founding by Catherine the Great in 1783 after the Ottoman Empire succeeded the peninsula to Russia. Putin told a closed NATO summit in Romania in 2008 that the military alliance was threatening Ukraine's very existence by courting its membership, according to a secret cable published by WikiLeaks. Thank you, WikiLeaks, for being there. Putin said Ukraine's borders were sewn together after World War II, and its claims to the Crimea, which belonged to Russia until native-born Nikita Khrushchev gave it to the Ukraine in 1954, was legally dubious. Or at least that's what Kurt Volker, the U.S. ambassador to NATO at the time, said in the cable. Putin demonstrated his willingness to back up words with action by sending troops to war against Georgia, another former Soviet state, over two Russian-speaking regions seeking independence. Sheila Galtwin, then the number two official at the U.S. Embassy in Kiev, said in a 2006 cable, quote, "They have done so by cynically fanning ethnic Russian chauvinism towards Crimean Tatars and the ethnic Ukrainians through manipulation of issues like the status of the Russian language, NATO, and alleged Tatar threat to Slavs." Now, Russians actually comprise about 59% of the Crimean population of 2 million, with about 24% Ukrainian and about 12% Tatar, according to 2001 census data. Russians make up about 17% of Ukraine's total population of about 45 million. Although everyone is focused on the Crimea, several eastern provinces of the Ukraine, centered around the city of Kharkiv, are similarly predominantly Russia. Everyone is holding the breath to see if Russia invades there to, quote, protect the oppressed or threatened Rossi, or ethnic Russians living there. The Russian foreign minister said it was considering protection requests from Russian-speaking Ukrainians. So it is possible there will be a repeat of the Crimea maneuver in the eastern Ukraine provinces. Now, Russia had about 15 sailors and soldiers stationed permanently there at their naval base in the Black Sea and around Sevastopol, the largest city in the Crimea. Now, Ukraine officials and Western observers now believe that Russia sent about another 6,000 or so troops to Crimea, with more and more arriving every hour. So it is now believed that there's well over 20,000 Russian troops there. The Russian fleet has blocked in the Ukrainian fleet and not allowed them to leave port. Russia has apparently supplied surface-to-air missiles, which are being offloaded from ships and ready for movement. The Russians have even taken over a gas plant and loading facility that's about 10 kilometers outside of the Crimean borders. Canada, the US, and the UK have suspended preparations for the G8 meeting scheduled in early June in Sochi in responses to the early Russian moves in the Ukraine. Now, of course, there is the referendum that has just taken place in Crimea, which has many flaws. Most notably, the only questions on the ballot were, do you want to become an independent state, or do you want to rejoin Russia? And these were not yes-no answers. It was you selected either one or the other. Because there was no option to remain part of Ukraine, those who supported this option, notably ethnic Ukrainians and the Crimea, opted to stay at home so as to delegitimate the whole operation. There is also an active harassment of any pro-Ukraine sentiment in the Crimea by the Russian/local armed militia. There have also been reports that up to 123% turnout happened at Sevastopol alone. How can this happen? Well, the people running the polls did not actually have access to the voter list that's found in Kiev. So instead, they allowed anyone with a passport to vote. Any passport. One reporter showed up with his Russian passport and was given a ballot. And remember, we said that there are a large number of Russian military forces in the region just because of the Black Sea fleet. And really, the numbers don't add up when you consider that all the majority, about 60% of the peninsula's population, are thought to be pro-Russian. The other 40% are strongly pro-Ukraine, especially the ethnic Tatars, who suffered persecution and expulsion under Russian rule. The Tatars account for about 15% of the population. So one must ask, if the pro-Russian vote was 97%, well, it's not really a credible number. But that, of course, assumed the referendum was anything more than a rubber stamp in the first place, which it was. To complicate issues even more, the West has complained about the seizure of power by the pro-Russian activists of the Crimea Parliament and the appointment of a new leader. This is spookily parallel to what happened in Kiev. And Russia, perhaps honestly, can't understand why the West was so quick to accept the overthrow of the Ukraine president, something the Russians didn't accept, adding a whole level of irony there, while the West was eager to accept the new acting PM for the Ukraine, and yet seemed so reluctant to do the same in the Crimea. Well, first, the overthrow, or revolution, if you will, in Kiev was at the end of weeks of violence, much of it sponsored by the now vacant president. Whereas revolution in the Crimea occurred after Russian troops started taking over everything. The revolution in the Ukraine was also ended by a negotiated agreement that included mediators from Poland, the EU, France, Germany. The revolution in Crimea occurred after armed troops took over the Crimean parliament and forced a vote to make Sergei Aksionov acting PM. Prior to the revolution, his party only held about 4% of the vote. It seems when you enter a parliament with machine guns and rocket launchers, well, much can change. Oh, did I mention that Aksionov was in charge of the paramilitary group that took over the parliament? Important point, I think. The revolution in Ukraine set elections for late May, while the vote in Crimea was done in less than 2 weeks after the, quote, revolution. Although I think coup might be a more better word. So now the vote is done, and Russia is fast-tracking annexation legislation through the Duma. How has the West responded? Well, weakly, if truth be known. They threatened economic sanctions, and they have followed through on that. Are they like the ones imposed on Iran? Not really. They have limited the travel of 10 for the US and 20 for the EU, individual Russians, and frozen these people's assets. Now, some of these are important. The former president of the Ukraine, Yanukovych, members of the Russian Duma, the leaders of, I guess I can call them, the revolutionary government in Crimea, and a number of top military units. Notably, it was not against any Russian corporation, resource, or even Putin himself. Pretty weak tea. So this raises the next question. Will this be like the Sudetenland? For those not steeped in history, the Sudetenland was part of Czechoslovakia that had a majority of ethnic Germans. Czechoslovakia itself was created as part of the fallout from World War I. It was, as Putin may have put it, sewn together and not what you would call a natural nation. In 1938, the pro-Nazi leader of the Sudeten German Party agitated for greater autonomy for the predominantly German Sudetenland, under the pretext of Slavic oppression of the German minority. Sound familiar? In an effort to avoid war, the Western powers forced Czechoslovakia to accept, quote, Sudeten self-determination, even if it was under the shroud of pro-Nazi-induced violence. And, of course, German troops immediately occupied the Sudetenland to protect Germans from the wrath of, according to Hitler, the slaughtering Slavs. This capitulation to Hitler was also called the Munich Agreement, promising peace in our time. Of course, no sooner was the ink dry than Germany invaded the rump Czechoslovakia and took over the area. This is a curious fact seldom mentioned, but after Germany annexed the Sudetenland, Poland and Hungary also annexed large portions of Czechoslovakia. So getting back to the neo-Tsarist Putin, will this be enough? Putin is on record as saying the greatest catastrophe of the 20th century was the collapse of the Soviet Union. So what is his next move? Will he attempt to recreate the Soviet Union? Or will he just try and reunite the scattered ethnic Russians under one rule? Or what? All that is sure is that Putin is in the driver's seat for now. We'll return after this break.
Science is the best tool ever devised for understanding the world.
To subscribe to the Radio Freethinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes, subscribe via iTunes or at RadioFreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@RadioFreethinker.com.
And we're back. Now, someone might think that maybe my perception of the events in the Crimea and Ukraine are a bit tainted. So I thought I would bring someone else in to sort of give you a different perspective of it. So this is John Green of Crash Course and Mental Floss fame, kind of giving his own take on the background to the crisis in the Crimea.
Good morning, Hank. It's Tuesday. I want to talk about Ukraine today, but this is extremely complicated, and I just want to apologize in advance for anything that I get wrong, slash leave out, slash oversimplify, okay? Okay. So this is Ukraine, the second largest country in Europe by area, and this is the Crimean Peninsula, which saw much of the fighting in the Crimean War that lasted from 1853 to 1856. It was sort of a Catholic versus Orthodox thing, but the larger cause was Europe fearing that Russia's power would expand as the Ottoman Empire declined. So Britain, France, and the kind of still a thing Ottoman Empire teamed up to eventually defeat Russia, and 500,000 people died, and it was generally pretty awful, and obviously resolved very little, since Europe just 60 years later would go ahead and have World War I. Then, toward the end of World War I, Russia had its famous communist revolution, and Ukraine enjoyed a brief period of independence, although enjoyed may not be quite the right verb. In fact, from 1917 to 1921, Ukraine was mired in endless wars among competing factions, including Poland and the USSR and Ukrainian nationalists, even some real live anarchists. It was all very complicated. It was also extremely violent. More than 1.5 million people died. And then finally, Ukraine became part of the USSR and things became more stable for a while. But then Stalin. As many as 10 million Ukrainians starved to death in 1932 and 1933 thanks to Stalin's agricultural policies, which were not just stupid, but also actively evil. I mean, there was widespread starvation in a country that is now the world's third largest exporter of grain. Then, following World War II, Stalin forcibly deported the Crimean Peninsula's entire indigenous population of ethnic Tatars to Central Asia. So if you want to point to one individual who's responsible for a lot of this, I don't want to, you know, call anyone out, but Stalin. Stalin also moved many ethnic Russians into Ukraine, especially into the Crimean Peninsula and the western part of the country, which is the industrial center. And then Stalin's successor, Khrushchev, decided to transfer the Crimean Peninsula from Russia to Ukraine in 1954. Why? Well, Khrushchev had lots of ties to Ukraine, but also the Crimean Peninsula is not actually physically attached to Russia. As you can see here, it is physically attached to Ukraine, and it gets all of its electricity and water from Ukraine, and it's easier to administer places you are physically connected to, which is why Alaska should be part of Canada, but that is a different story. Okay, so quick contemporary demographic snapshot. Today, about 67% of people living in Ukraine speak Ukrainian as their first language. About 30% speak Russian, although only about 17% of the population identify as ethnically Russian. And as you can see here, Russian is spoken mostly in the West and in the Crimean Peninsula. Many Tatars have returned to Crimea since the breakup of the Soviet Union, but today they only make up about 12% of the population. Okay, so flash forward to December of 1991, after the Soviet Union has broken up, Ukraine had a nationwide referendum, and 90% of people, including a majority of those living in the Crimean Peninsula, voted for independence from Russia. But Ukraine remained much more closely aligned with Russia than many other former Soviet republics did, like, for instance, Estonia, which is now part of the European Union. In 2004, there was an election, and there were widespread reports of vote rigging, but the Russian-friendly Viktor Yanukovych was elected. The opposition leader, Viktor Yushchenko, led massive street protests in Kiev that came to be known as the Orange Revolution. That opposition leader, Yushchenko, was disfigured and almost died as a result of mysterious poisoning. Side note, but the number of mysterious poisonings in Russia and Eastern Europe has absolutely skyrocketed since Putin came to power in Russia, which I'm sure is a coincidence. Anyway, the Orange Revolution protest led to a second election, and the poisoned opposition leader, Yushchenko, won, and yay, everything would be made of puppies and freedom and rainbows and friendliness toward Europe forever, except no. For one thing, a lot of people in Ukraine, especially in the western part, want to be more closely allied with Russia, and also, despite being an economist, Yushchenko wasn't very good at running the Ukrainian economy. Also, Yushchenko couldn't push through austerity measures needed to deal with Ukraine's rising debt, and his friendliness toward Europe infuriated Russia, which cut off gas supplies briefly, but disastrously, to Ukraine in 2006. So by 2010, Ukraine was being led by the Europe-friendly and somewhat corrupt Yulia Tymoshenko, and then there were elections. And the presidential election, declared free and fair by international observers, was won by the aforementioned Russian-friendly Viktor Yanukovych. In November 2013, Yanukovych announced that Ukraine would abandon an agreement to strengthen ties with the EU and would instead become a closer ally of Russia. And that is when the protests began in Kiev's Independence Square. Those protests grew and grew until February 20th, when dozens of protesters were killed by military and police, and the next day, Yanukovych disappeared from Kiev. The protesters had won. They installed a new temporary government to prepare for new elections, and then the Putin regime marched into the Crimean Peninsula, ostensibly to protect ethnic Russians there and Russian military installations. But this violation of Ukraine's territorial integrity is known in diplomatic circles as, like, a big effing deal. Crimea is already an autonomous province with its own government, so what does it want? Does it want independence? That would be hard. All of their electricity and water has to come through Ukraine. Does it want to be part of Russia again? That would be impossible without Ukrainian cooperation, which right now seems inconceivable. So that's where we are right now. I mean, unless something has happened in the last 30 minutes. So here's one narrative of these events. An unpopular and ineffective but democratically elected politician was removed from power by a mob of protesters, and the new unelected parliament briefly passed a law saying that only Ukrainian can be the official language of the country, even though many people in the country speak Russian. Furthermore, this new government wants to become part of the EU, which might bring NATO missiles to Russia's border, and that is unacceptable to Russia. I mean, I'm American. We've had some very ineffective and unpopular leaders, and what we've done is just waited for them not to be president anymore. But here's another narrative. A tyrannical leader who ordered the murder of peaceful protesters was chased from power and replaced by a government that will transition Ukraine toward free and fair elections, and Russia responded to that by invading Ukraine. Hank, I'm not trying to make a false equivalence here, but I think it's really important to understand both of these narratives. And I wanted to give a little more historical context than we've been seeing on the news, because it helps us to understand that the pull between Western Europe and Russia in Ukraine is not new. I mean, the word Ukraine itself means borderland. It has for centuries functioned as the border between West and East. What Ukraine needs is stability, decades of stability, so it can grow to have its own identity, to have relationships with both Europe and Russia without being controlled by either. Right now, that dream seems really far away, but 60 years ago, Japan was in ruins. 25 years ago, Germany was divided into two countries. 12 years ago, Sierra Leone was mired in a horrific and seemingly endless civil war. But today, it's the second fastest growing economy in the world. The arc of history is long, Hank. Let's hope that it bends toward peace. Hank, I'll see you on Friday.
So with that context provided, let's take a moment for another break, and we'll be back with some gems from the web.
Despite the fact that 8 in 10 Canadians are against warrantless and costly online spying, the government remains stubborn, set to cement this scheme into law. With their huge PR budget, they've unleashed a reckless and irresponsible campaign that suggests warrantless collection of our private data is on par with a phone book. We can't let them trick Canadians. Go to www.openmedia.ca now to find out what you can do to get involved and stop this smoke and mirrors campaign the government has started.
And we're back. In our continuing series of bringing wisdom from the web, I have a couple of clips from C.P. Gray, someone that I think our audience should get to know because he explains things really well and it's very entertaining. So he did a series of shows about our electoral system. So I'm going to play you them, beginning with the first past the post, then followed by gerrymandering. Let's begin.
Welcome to The Problem with First Past the Post Voting Explained by me, CGP Gray. The royal family has a problem, but this isn't just any royal family. These are the lions, rulers of the jungle since time immemorial. There are protests over the monarchy's absolute power, and the citizens of the animal kingdom want a say in how they are governed. Bending to the pressure, Lion has abdicated his crown, and King is to be in elected office. To ensure a smooth transition, and because she is craftier than her husband, the Queen Lioness is remaining on the throne with the power to set the rules for all elections in her kingdom. She has declared that all citizens get one and only one vote, and that the candidate with the most votes wins the crown. This method of voting is most often called first past the post, awkwardly abbreviated as FPTP, or winner take all. The system is simple, fair, and logical, right? Actually, no. It's a terrible, terrible idea. Why? Well, to see the problems with first past the post, let's watch the first election unfold in the animal kingdom. It's an exciting time for the burgeoning democracy, and 7 hopeful candidates come forward to run and represent their parties. They put on their best campaigns, citizens head out to the polls, and the votes are counted. The results come in as follows. Turtle gets 9% of the vote, Monkey gets 18, Gorilla gets 19, Owl gets 13, Leopard gets 20, Tiger gets 15, and Snake gets 6. Under the rules of First Past the Post, Leopard is crowned the winner and she gets to rule for the length of her term. But take another look at the results and you'll see the first problem with this system, minority rule. The vast majority of citizens, 80%, wanted someone else as king, but Leopard still won. There were only 7 candidates in this race, but if you imagine if there had been 20, she might have only gotten 5% of the vote, but still been elected. This problem of minority rule is only the beginning. The second problem with First Past the Post is that, given enough time, it results in an inevitable, unavoidable two-party system. Why? To see, let's watch what happens over several election cycles. Leopard has had her term in office, and it's again election time in the Young Democracy. Only now, all the citizens of Animal Kingdom remember the results from last time. This information changes how they'll behave, particularly snake and turtle voters, who must face the reality that they backed unappealing extremist candidates who don't have a chance of winning. Turtle voters, who were unhappy under leopard rule, decide to back the candidate who has the best chance of winning, Gorilla. Now, snake voters want to vote for Tiger, who is the candidate they have the most in common with, but they're afraid to because Leopard is running a negative campaign against her competitors. Snake voters, not liking the idea of gorilla rule, vote strategically for Leopard. The final result looks like this, with Leopard getting 26% of the vote and Gorilla getting 28%, making him the new king. Snake and Turtle, seeing their dismal results and knowing the cost of their campaigns, decide to drop out of future races. What started out as a 7-party system is now down to 5. Fast forward to the next election. Only 5 candidates run, and again the voters remember what happened last time. In this election, it's owl voters who recognize that their candidate cannot win. They are centrist voters and less ideological than the rest of the animal kingdom. As such, they don't really like Gorilla or Leopard. Both Gorilla and Leopard know this, so they each run negative campaigns to capitalize on the fears of the centrists. Owl voters split their vote and are mostly voting against the candidate they dislike rather than supporting the candidate they do like. After this election, Gorilla gets 33% of the vote and Leopard gets 34%, making her the winner. Owl, as did Turtle and Snake before her, drops out of the race. In the last election we'll look at, Monkey and Tiger voters are unhappy. They both really like the candidates they have supported, but they now have to compromise. Monkey voters agree with Gorilla on few issues, but they really don't like Leopard. And Tiger voters agree with Leopard on some issues, but they really don't like Gorilla. They strategically abandon their preferred candidate out of fear of the one they disagree with the most becoming king. The final results are Leopard 49% and Gorilla 51%, with him being crowned the king. Monkey and Tiger are the last candidates to drop out, and now the Animal Kingdom is left with a two-party system. Because of the centrist and swayable owl voters, in future elections, Leopard might take the crown, then Gorilla wins it back, only to lose it to Leopard again, but the two parties never change. The citizens of Animal Kingdom ended up with the system, not because they are lazy voters or because that's what they really wanted, but because the mathematics of how the system is set up. Inevitably, given enough time, all first-past-the-post systems trend towards two main parties. But the choices of the voters still hasn't changed since that first election. Only 2/5 of them wanted either Leopard or Gorilla as their first choice, and 3/5 of them wanted someone else as their first choice. It's this majority of the voters that becomes disinterested in the democratic process because they feel they have no meaningful way to express their real preferences. But it only gets worse from here. If the citizens of Animal Kingdom are divided into groups before they vote, they are susceptible to gerrymandering. Gerrymandering is a bit tricky, but imagine a block of 10 homes each with one voter inside. 3 are leopard voters, 3 are gorilla voters, and 4 are owl voters. If they're divided up into groups before they vote, whoever decides where the lines are drawn has enormous influence over who wins the election. For example, if you group the 3 leopard voters with the 2 owl voters, and do the same with the 3 gorilla voters, you can eliminate owl from the election, even though owl voters have the largest minority and would win under a straight first-past-the-post vote. If the leopard or gorilla parties are in charge when the voting boundaries are drawn, they have enormous incentive to carve out safe seats for themselves. But more on gerrymandering in another video. Bah, I hear you say, vote third party and change the system. This brings us to the final and possibly worst problem of first past the post, the spoiler effect. Imagine now that it's been years and years of gorilla or leopard rule. Tiger decides it's time to enter the race. He thinks that the voters are tired of the status quo and he has a shot at winning. He sets up his campaign office, gets a surprising amount of gold and donations, and gets on the Animal News Network to debate with the main candidates. Election night comes around, but alas, Tiger gets only 15% of the vote, mostly from Leopard voters who are closest to him on the political spectrum. Gorilla easily beats Leopard and gets to be king. This is the first-past-the-post system at its worst. The better a third-party candidate does, the more it hurts its own voters by guaranteeing a loss for the party they most agree with and a win for the party they most disagree with. And don't forget, Gorilla is no fool. He knows how the system works. Where do you think some of those gold donations came from? Meanwhile, the Queen Lioness is displeased. She's been observing the elections and sees that the system is bad for her subjects. And she's been thinking, what makes a good voting system? Well, you should be able to vote for the candidate who you like the most without worrying. More choice in representatives is better. The system shouldn't be susceptible to gerrymandering. And it should be open to new political parties. Luckily for the Queen, there are several different voting systems to choose from, including the alternative vote, but that will have to be discussed in detail at another time. Queen Lion of the Animal Kingdom is giving more democracy to her citizens by adding a legislative branch to the government. The citizens each get one vote and are divided into ranges. Each range will elect one representative to send to the newly created Jungle Council. To best understand how the system works, let's take a look at a small colony where there are just two political parties, the Buffalo and Jackalope. This colony is divided into four ranges. In the first election, Jackalope candidates win two of them, and Buffalo candidates win the rest. All is well for several election cycles until the Animal Kingdom census taker comes around and shows that the population has both moved and grown. To better represent the larger population, a new seat is added to the Jungle Council, so the range's boundaries must be redrawn. This is where the trouble begins. Redrawing electoral boundaries is a huge political problem. To help them, the representatives of the Jungle Council hire a Weasley consultant to figure out where the new boundaries should go. If Weasel draws rectangular boundaries, everything will be okay, because the Jungle Council will, as close as possible, reflect how the citizens vote. However, Weasel doesn't do this. Instead, he tells the Buffalo Party that, for a price, he can turn their slim majority into a landslide victory in the election. With a supermajority on the Jungle Council, the Buffalo wouldn't have to listen to those pesky Jackalope filibusters anymore, so the Buffalo gladly pay up. How can Weasel deliver on his promise? It's depressingly simple. By packing together as many Jackalope voters into one range as possible and spreading the rest of them out, the Buffalo Party can win an additional seat without any voters switching allegiance. What Weasel and the Buffalo have done is called gerrymandering, the intentional changing of electoral boundaries for their benefit. Several election cycles later, the underrepresented and disgruntled Jackalope Party approaches Weasel and asks if he can manipulate the ranges to be in their favor instead of in the Buffalo's. Why, indeed, he can. Using the same trick, Weasel packs Buffalo voters into a few ranges and spreads the rest among the Jackalope supporters. After the election, the Jackalopes, who represent a minority of voters, are now, nonetheless, the majority party on the Jungle Council. This is the terrible power of gerrymandering. Weasel can take the exact same voters and get either party to win the election. Unsurprisingly, Weasel's business grows, and eventually every colony in the Animal Kingdom pays him to gerrymander their ranges. With so many clients, Weasel now uses his computer to test hundreds of thousands of range combinations with elaborate statistical models of voter behavior to get the results he needs. Queen Lion has seen what Weasel is up to and banishes him from her kingdom. But the census taker reminds her that ranges still need to be redrawn as the population changes, so how is it going to be decided? Queen Lion suggests the obvious solution: a bipartisan committee must agree on all new range boundaries. This seems like a good idea. After all, if both parties have to agree on the ranges, then they must end up being fair to everyone. But after a few election cycles using this solution, Queen Lion notices that she always sees the same faces on the Jungle Council. Representatives almost never get defeated in their elections. It turns out that the interests of the representatives and the interests of the citizens are not the same. Citizens want elections where the candidates have to earn their vote. These are close elections where either candidate has a chance of winning. But representatives don't want close elections, they want safe elections. Elections where they run in a range that is filled with supporters. Because the representatives are in charge of the boundaries, they make the safest ranges possible. So, bipartisan committees are not enough. To truly fix gerrymandering, there are three options. The first is to set up a politically independent commission of appointed experts or judges to draw the boundaries. Independent commissions are much better than bipartisan committees, but still not ideal because they usually group similar areas together, so the elections are uncompetitive. And there's always the possibility that the independent commission is not as independent as it appears. The second option is to let math decide the boundaries. There are a number of ways to mathematically divide an area into equally populous ranges. The simplest example of this is called the shortest split line method. Find the shortest line that splits the voters in twain and repeat as necessary until all the ranges are made. This is much better than an independent commission, but it does have the problem of occasionally producing skewed election results just through the pure bad luck of where the boundaries are drawn. But by publishing the algorithm used, all citizens can check the results and be confident that there is no intentional bias in the system. The last solution is an unexpected one. Hire back the Weasel and embrace gerrymandering. But this time, pay him to make the winners most closely match the voters as a whole. While it seems unsavory, this is actually the best way to avoid disproportionate representation, which is, by far, the worst problem of gerrymandering. But considering these three solutions leaves Queen Lion grumpy. The first two are improvements, but still may result in uncompetitive elections or disproportionate results, while the third just feels wrong. Gerrymandering to avoid the problems of gerrymandering is odd. Remembering what she learned about voting before, she realizes that all this gerrymandering is really just a symptom of a more fundamental problem, the method by which each citizen gets only one vote and elects only one representative. There are ways to eliminate gerrymandering and restore competitive elections to make her citizens happy. But to do that, Queen Lion is going to have to make some big, fundamental changes to her democracy. Queen Lion of the Animal Kingdom is looking to improve her democracy. She recently allowed citizens to elect representatives to the Jungle Council, which governs the kingdom. However, she recognizes that her citizens are not happy with the voting system. Let's watch an election on one of the small islands of her kingdom to see why. On this island, there are three political parties, the two big ones, Kia and Tuatara, and a small third party, Kakapo. On election day, the citizens each cast one vote for a local candidate they want to represent the range they live in. The results are as follows, with the average across the island that Tuatara gets 49%, Kia gets 48%, and Kakapo gets 3%. The election is run using first past the post, meaning that the candidate with the most votes wins. Because Tuatara got the most votes in each range, they get to control 100% of the seats on the council. And this is why so many citizens are unhappy. The majority of them, the 51% who voted for other parties, get no representation on the council at all. This seems unfair to Queen Lion, but she's not sure how to fix it. The citizens like having local representatives and don't want to change the range boundaries. But luckily Kiwi, one of the citizens of this island, has a suggestion for Queen Lion on how she can make the system better while keeping local representation and leaving the ranges as they are. The idea is called Mixed Member Proportional, or MMP, and it makes two changes. The number of seats on the council is doubled, and each citizen now gets two votes, not one. Here's how it works. At first, election day for Kiwi is just the same as before. He gets a list of candidates running to represent his local range on the council. Kiwi picks one, and the winner will be the candidate with the most votes. So far, the system is no better. Tuatara again wins all the local elections, and still more than half of the citizens don't have any representation. But here's how Kiwi's second vote and those extra seats on the council fix this. Kiwi uses his second vote to pick his favorite political party. These second votes are tallied up and show the percentage of support that each of the political parties has among the citizens as a whole and reveals how imbalanced the council is so far. To fix this imbalance, members of the political parties are added one at a time to make the council more proportional. Tuatara is the most overrepresented and Kia the most underrepresented, so Kia gets the first empty seat. This continues, adding one Kia at a time until both Tuatara and Kia are overrepresented and Kakapo is underrepresented, so they get the final seat. Now the Jungle Council represents, as close as possible, the actual preferences of the citizens, which is a huge improvement over the old first-past-the-post method. There is, however, one interesting question that should arise at this point. Exactly who decides which members of the party get those extra seats? The way it works is that, before the election, the political parties make a list of their favorite candidates in the order they want them to get on the council. So if there is only one extra seat for their party, the name at the top of their list is chosen. If they get two extra seats, the first two are chosen, and so on. This makes MMP a bit different from other voting methods in that it makes political parties an official part of the way the election works. This may give the party leaders greater control over their members because they can reward or punish their actions by changing their placement on the party list. While this may be a disadvantage of MMP, there are a number of other benefits that Queen Lion in particular likes. Because fewer votes are wasted, it mostly eliminates gerrymandering and prevents minority rule. It also gives more choice to the citizens by encouraging political diversity. This point is worth expanding on. Notice how, with MMP, the percentage of votes for the local representatives isn't the same as for the parties. This is because in the local election, citizens have to vote strategically. For example, Kakapo voters don't like Tuatara at all, but they can tolerate Kia. Since there are so few Kakapo voters, they know that their candidate doesn't have a chance of winning the local election, so it's really a race between the two big parties. Thus, many of the Kakapo will vote Kia in the hope that he might win and be their representative. However, when it comes to voting for their favorite political party, this strategy doesn't matter. The more votes a party gets, the more representatives it has on the council, so citizens are free to vote for smaller parties they like, knowing that every vote counts. Queen Lion reviews her options and decides to switch her kingdom to MMP. Now, for the first time, the Jungle Council is a true reflection of what her citizens want.
I hope you found that interesting. So, it looks like we're at the end of the show. So this is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning 100 billion suns. The horizon of the Milky Way. The cosmos is full beyond
one time, ladies and gentlemen. We are live and direct